the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. We're going to be talking about a very interesting topic today that has emerged and has made its way from National Review Magazine to the New York Times in less than 24 hours. Very interesting here. The New York Times picking up from the article in which Karen Venerable Morin wrote, Caveat Parens, One Family's Adventure in Gender-Neutral Housing. Here you have a parent who writes an article about her daughter's most recent dorm room assignment at Stanford University. This is not a suite. This is a dorm room. Okay, follow this closely. This daughter is now in a dorm room that she shares with one other girl and two boys. Okay, it gets a lot more complicated. She doesn't have a choice. In other words, some of these universities are moving so quickly into a brave new world that it is just expected that as a part of the student contract, you'd be willing to share not only a floor, a dorm building, a suite, but now a room with members of the opposite sex. And it turns out it's not just Stanford University. It turns out that this is really emblematic, perhaps just indicative of where higher education is going, especially in the most elite universities. This particular mother, Karen Venerable Morin, says evidently Stanford University felt that the prestige of a Stanford University degree was enough for us to put up with this, but she says no. And she and her husband informed their daughter that they will not be paying her tuition to Stanford University for the conclusion of her degree. Now, the topic here can sound scandalous, and it better be scandalous, but the topic here is actually more than looking at this scandalous development at Stanford University. It's looking at the kind of gender revolution and social revolution that the universities are now giving themselves to represent. We're going to be talking about some other things as well today, but I was just on the University of Pennsylvania campus, and I was on that campus looking around. What a beautiful, venerable, historic place. But you begin to understand what's really going on. And so many of these universities, and you come to understand, these are the engines of a social transformation. These are the factories of the future. And if you look at policies like this, it tells you a great deal of what parents need to know. Caveat parents, in other words, parent beware. That's the title of the article in National Review Magazine. I think it's very interesting that the New York Times picked up on this. And the New York Times found it also very, very interesting. Of course, the New York Times is probably going to take a different editorial slant on it than did National Review Magazine. You come to the end of the New York Times piece. It says this. First came co-educational colleges, then dorms, then bathrooms. Now on a few campuses, there are co-educational rooms. Listen to this. Here at Swarthmore College, Courtney Coffey, a woman, and Woot Leverzett, a man, share the upstairs bedroom in Lodge 3. They say it's no big deal. True, they change in the large walk-in closet, but otherwise, it's much like rooming with a friend of the same sex. Some may leap to prurient conclusions about a policy allowing a young man and a woman to share a dormitory room. Some might. But perhaps, surprisingly, the policy here is less about sex than about sexual politics and the increasingly powerful presence of gay and lesbian groups on the campus. Okay, there is a tripwire right there. Did you notice that? Now you come to understand this has a great deal to do with the homosexual revolution and with transgender, transsexual people, because if you're bending all those gender rules, then you really are going to be pushing back against the very idea that that gender is important when it comes to room assignment. We're going to be talking about what this means for America. The phone number is 877-893-8255. Caveat parents, parents beware. Oh, you bet. But there's more here than just a story about some isolated campuses and some concerned parents. The phone number to join the conversation is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. At my website at albertmohler.com, I posted an article this morning entitled The Parable of the Unwilling Physician. I hope you'll find the article. You'll find it by going to my website. And I posted it because of a fascinating story in the Los Angeles Times about a doctor who does not perform assisted suicide, even now that after the vote back in November of last year, the state of Washington now has moved into the column of those states that allow physicians and hospitals, healthcare professionals, to be engaged in physician-assisted suicide. Now, here's the story. The majority of doctors are not going along with this. Here's a piece of good news for you. Most doctors believe that they are healers, not killers. I find that a very reassuring thing. As a matter of fact, I'm frightened to know that there are doctors that do participate in physician-assisted suicide, but this is an article in which people are complaining about the doctors that will not go along. It turns out that once you get out of the western coast there of Washington State, you get out of the big population centers, Tacoma, Seattle, etc., it's hard to find a doctor that participates in physician-assisted suicide. Some people consider that a scandal. However, one of the interesting aspects of this whole assisted suicide debate is the fact that doctors and doctors' professional organizations, medical associations, are generally very clearly against it. In Great Britain, there's a lot of furor right now over physician-assisted suicide. Parliament seems to be ready to debate the issue, and there are those who are pushing for the legalization of euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide in Great Britain. You know what the break is on that whole process? The doctors, who overwhelmingly say they don't want to go along. You know, I was reassured by something I found in writing my article. Did you know that the American Medical Association has a clear principle against physician-assisted suicide? I'm reading to you from Opinion 2.211 on physician-assisted suicide from the AMA Code of Medical Ethics. This is good news. Listen, physician-assisted suicide is fundamentally incompatible with the physician's role as healer, would be difficult or impossible to control, and would pose serious societal risks. Instead of participating in assisted suicide, physicians must aggressively respond to the needs of patients at the end of life. Patients should not be abandoned once it is determined that cure is impossible. End quote. You know, I have to tell you, as a patient, I find that reassuring. That means, by the way, there is must language here, and anyone who knows the kind of ethical and legal language of professional organizations or accrediting agencies knows that must language means this is a requirement. Let me read to this section to you again. Physicians must aggressively respond to the needs of patients at the end of life. That is, rather than end the life. One particular doctor quoted in the story in the Los Angeles Times put it better than just about anyone else. Dr. Idar Roman, a family practitioner, said, "To me personally, giving a patient a suicide pill is like abdicating my role. I'm here to heal and make better. And the other just doesn't seem like that's what I went into medicine to do." I also like what was said by William L. Toffler, professor of family medicine and executive director of Physicians for Compassionate Care. He said this: "The solution to suffering never is to eliminate the sufferer." That's pretty clear. The solution to suffering is not to get rid of the sufferer, but to ameliorate the suffering. Let me ask you a question. This is an interesting question. It'd be an interesting question for us to take up on this program. Would you want to go to a physician that participates in physician-assisted suicide? Would you want to go to a doctor that, under certain circumstances, decides that the way to solve the problem is to kill the patient? I find that a very interesting question, and my guess is others would find that interesting as well. By the way, this plays right into the whole conscience clause debate. We'll be talking about that and following that issue very closely on this program, because the Obama administration is looking at either changing or limiting the conscience clauses that allow physicians and other healthcare professionals on conscience to refuse to participate in things like physician-assisted suicide and the abortion of unborn human infants. If that right is taken away, we are indeed in very, very big trouble. Other interesting stuff that's going on, there is a debate, the New York Times is also part of this, about what we should call climate change. And it points out that there is a public relations problem right now, in that so many of those pushing for some action against climate change have been referring to what is now called global warming. Now, John Broder, writing for the New York Times, says the term turns people off, fostering images of shaggy-haired liberals, economic sacrifice, and complex scientific disputes. That, by the way, according to extensive polling and focus group sessions conducted by Eco America, a nonprofit environmental marketing and messaging firm in Washington. Now, you're going to love this. Listen carefully. Instead of grim warnings about global warming, the firm advises talk about, quote, our deteriorating atmosphere, end quote. Drop discussions of common carbon dioxide and bring up, quote, moving away from the dirty fuels of the past, end quote. Don't confuse people with cap and trade. Use terms like, quote, cap and cashback, end quote, or, quote, pollution reduction refund, end quote. Well, we are told that increasingly in America, everything is a commodity, consumerism is king, and marketing is the medium. It looks like when it comes even to now ecological issues to be debated in the public square, that's very much the case. You know, it just reminds us, folks, when you're watching the news, listening to the cultural conversation, the way issues are framed, the language that is used, the euphemisms that are coined, the neologisms, the kind of new terms that become terms of art, they all betray where there really is an ideological agenda. These are the folks who want you to buy into global warming, and regardless of where you are on the issue, we ought to resist the fact that there are people who say it's really all about public relations. Start talking about pollution reduction refund. After all, who doesn't like a refund? When we come back, we're going to talk about what we really find out about the culture of American higher education when we find boys and girls sharing dormitory rooms together, whether they want to or not. I'm Albert Rowland.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Moeller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Moeller Program. I think the best way for me to really let you know what's going on here is for you to hear it in the words of Karen Venable Morin, writing at National Review Magazine. I'm going to read it just as she wrote it. If sharing a bedroom with a student of the opposite sex is not your idea of appropriate college housing for your son or daughter, beware. The college or university to which you have just sent a deposit may have other ideas. Poor Maria, I said to my husband. We were reading the paper at the breakfast table during Christmas week. What's up, he asked. The University of Chicago has sent a letter to parents announcing that they'll allow men and women to room together next year, and they won't necessarily be informing parents about their children's room assignments, end quote. My friend Maria has a child at the University of Chicago. I thought they were a conservative school, said my husband. Evidently not, I replied. It never occurred to me that the parents of Chicago students were lucky to be getting that letter. A few weeks later, I called my daughter at Stanford to see how her course selection had worked out for the winter quarter. And how's the new room, I asked. She had told us over Christmas break that her current dorm, a co-op where students cook and clean for themselves, required students to change rooms every quarter. That's how it began. And as I explained to my astonished mother-in-law when the dust had settled, it just got worse and worse. She's sharing a room with one other girl and two boys, I said. You mean a suite? No, I said. I mean a bedroom. My mother-in-law couldn't believe it. But wait, I said, it gets worse. She didn't ask for this room assignment. She missed the dorm meeting because she had a friend visiting from the East Coast. She appointed a proxy and said she wanted a room with no smoking and no sex in the room, but she didn't ask for a single-sex room. Should she? Asked my mother-in-law. Well, apparently, but she says she didn't think it was necessary. She asked to get out, right? Wrong. Her dorm had a 7-hour room meeting, and she doesn't want to upset everyone's consensus arrangements. Plus, she says, it's no big deal. So where does she get dressed? That's the same question I ask, I said. She says she gets dressed in the bathroom. We told her this arrangement was unacceptable to us. She asked around, she later reported, and she couldn't find anyone willing to swap with her, so she proposed that she sleep on a futon in one of the 2 or 3 all-girl rooms in the dorm, and we accepted that proposal. When I explained the situation to my very liberal, hip Los Angeles sister, she said, so she's paying board money for a closet? Who are the boys? My mother-in-law asked. Does she know them? Well, she thinks she knows them, I said. She knows them from the dorm, from this year. Knowing how closely related inappropriate sexual behavior and substance abuse are, I asked her if they drink. She told us that one of them doesn't drink, and the other one is a happy drunk. She thinks that makes her safe, end quote. All right, the story goes on, and we'll provide the link to it at the site for the program today. As you go and find the program online, you'll find references to both the article by Karen Venable Morin at National Review and the article by Jacques Steinberg at the New York Times. I wanted you to hear that because my guess is there are an awful lot of parents right now who are kind of in shock, saying, how could that happen at any college or university? I hope you heard the multiple levels of problems we're facing here. That you have a co-ed room, co-ed bedroom. You're talking about boys and girls together, young men, young women together in one room, sleeping in one room, 4 beds, 4 kids, 2 sexes. Okay, then you've got the substance abuse issue. Then you've got the rooms that are kind of designated. These are sex rooms, and those are no sex rooms. You know, do you want to send your kid to a school where right down the hall in the suite, you know, you got the sex room here and the no sex room here. You got the substance abuse room here and the other room here. Here you've got one girl rooming with one other girl and two boys. And one of them, one of the boys doesn't drink and the other one is, quote, a happy drunk. This to me is one of the most bizarre things I've ever read. And if it had just been a National Review, you would say, well, that's just perhaps some kind of conservative parent who's just on a rant. It's now in the New York Times. And the New York Times also thinks it's strange, but the New York Times, of course, doesn't think it's immoral. Which evidently, tribute to Karen Venerable Morin, she does. She and her husband clearly saw this as an immoral and unacceptable arrangement. You know, one of the things we face in this country right now is that you do not have to believe in very much of a sexual morality to be considered an absolute prude. You don't have to believe in very many sexual rules to be considered some kind of intolerant fundamentalist. If you are a parent who believes that your child ought to be in the dorm with students of the same gender, you are just backward, a throwback to some kind of previous moral age. I think you're right, by the way, but this is the reality of what we live in. And to tell you the truth, I'm on college campuses all the time. Over the last year, I've been on, I don't know, most of the Ivy League campuses. I've been on several of the Big Ten campuses. Like I say, just over the weekend, I was at University of Pennsylvania campus. I think I know pretty much what's going on these campuses. And if you want to know what's going on the campus, you don't just walk in the library. That's important. You certainly not just walk into the admissions office. That's the sales department. You walk around where the students are. You look at the notices on the bulletin boards. You look at the kinds of things in the student newspaper. You look at the kind of stuff that's sold right on the periphery of the campus, and then you find out what's going on the campus. But I'll tell you, I was shocked by this story. Honestly, I was. Because I was not aware that on so many of these college campuses, you actually had co-ed rooms, bedrooms. And you know, I have talked to students who've come to do graduate work at the seminary who've told me, you know, that they've come from major universities, large universities, state universities, prestigious private universities, where they said, you know, if our parents knew what was going on these campuses, there would hardly be a parent who'd pay the bills. But there's another angle here, and this is the one that really, really needs to be in our mind. Here it is. Karen Venerable Morin puts it exactly right when she says, you know, these colleges assume that the prestige of a diploma from that institution is just so important and prestigious that parents will put up with just about anything for their kids to go there. I want you to read, well, just listen as I read the last paragraph of her article. She says this. Well, the last two paragraphs. She says this. My hope looking forward is to warn other parents. Stanford and many other colleges and universities do not respect their common sense values. The university seeks to undermine those values. That's a very important point. She says it just right. The university seeks to undermine those values. If parents don't want gender-neutral housing for their children, they need to talk with their money, the only voice the university will allow them. Otherwise, parents will have to resign themselves to the risk of paying a heavier cost than they expect for their children's education. Stanford and at least 50 other colleges and universities. 50 other! You have to get to the last paragraph to find out that it's Stanford and 50 other, at least 50 other colleges and universities are promoting through their dormitory arrangements an ideology of gender that we personally reject and oppose. There will probably be plenty of families willing to bet their children's happiness on the prestige of a Stanford degree. We, however, are not among them. We told our daughter that we would not pay for her final quarter. If she wanted to stay at Stanford, she would have to take out a loan. When she protested that we were changing the terms of her attendance at the university, we told her that as far as we were concerned, it was Stanford that had changed the deal. Our morality is not for sale. End quote. Did you hear that? You know, I just find it absolutely insightful on her part that she says, look, these colleges are out to undermine parental values. It's not that they are acting in casual disregard for parental values. They are out to undermine parental values. But then she comes back, and I think this is where Christians need to have a particularly serious self-examination. She says, obviously Stanford and another university like this are going to bet that parents are going to prefer the prestige of a Stanford degree to the assurance that their values will not be undermined. And then she points to the real scandal. There are parents who are paying $250,000 for their kids to be indoctrinated in this new sexual gender revolution. The phone number is 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. Here's the question. If your kid got a scholarship to go to one of these schools under these circumstances, would you let them go? What's the price of the value? We'll be right back.
Listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. This is what is really at stake here when you start thinking about this whole issue of co-ed rooms, dormitory rooms, on college campuses. And again, the news report here is that on at least 50 American college and university campuses, young men and young women are expected to room together in a room. Now, you know, just looking at this from any kind of rational perspective, you really are just going to have to deny human nature to believe that that the wrong things are not going to be on the mind if not on the agenda. That's just not going to work. And I just have to wonder, what is really going on to make it plausible that you would put young men of that age and young women of that age together in one room? Well, I think what makes it plausible is exactly what the New York Times is talking about. And so you're looking at a very liberal newspaper that gets it. It gets it clearly. Jock Steinberg, writing at the Choice column of the New York Times, comes to the very end and shows that he gets it. He says, some may leap to prurient conclusions about a policy allowing a young man and woman to share a dormitory room. Well, yeah, you bet. I think the first person to jump to believe that's a prurient conclusion is going to be spelled dad. But she goes on and he goes on to write, but perhaps surprisingly, the policy here is less about sex than about sexual politics and the increasingly powerful presence of gay and lesbian groups on campus, end quote. I think that is so, so true. I think it probably is less about sex than about sexual politics and about the influence and increasingly powerful presence, to quote Steinberg, of gay and lesbian groups on campus. I think when it comes down to the crucial issue, Karen Venable Morin has it just about right when she says, you know, the issue is, will parents go along with this? Will parents be willing to say, all right, I want my child to have the prestige of a University of Chicago degree. I want my child to have the social advantages of a Stanford University degree. So I'm willing to put up with this. And let me just remind you that on both of those campuses, parents cannot keep this from happening. If you accept that your child is going to be a student at this school and enrolled there for room and board, you cannot keep this from happening. And at least at both of these schools, parents will not even know unless the child decides to tell. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. As scandalous as all this is, and I hope you are appropriately scandalized, and I gave attention to this today because I think it's one of those issues that in its scandalousness really crystallizes a moment of moral importance for us. But beyond the scandal, I want to ask you, isn't there a deep moral issue here about what we're really looking for in the education of our children? And I think most of us have clearly bought into the understanding that a university or college education is important for our children. And I believe in this economy, in this world, it probably is. I'm the president of a college and graduate seminary. But I'll tell you, it isn't worth losing a child's soul. It isn't worth putting a son or a daughter in a situation of this kind of moral risk and temptation. And it isn't worth, so far as I'm concerned, putting children, even young adults, in the context of this kind of social revolution. I think Ms. Morin is exactly right when she says these universities are doing their very best, quote, to undermine the values of parents. I think that's exactly right. The phone number again, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Okay, here's another way to look at this story. Evidently, there are thousands and thousands of American parents willing to put up with this, quite willing to write the checks for this. And I think the formula in their mind is very clear. My child graduates from Stanford, real good chance of getting into law school. My child has a Stanford degree, real good chance of getting into a very, very good professional direction. You take away Stanford, you take away the rest? Maybe not. Let's go to Louisville, Kentucky. Sienna is listening on WFIA. Go ahead, Sienna.
Hi there, Dr. Mueller. Well, first of all, I have three older brothers, and I can't imagine any two girls wanting to room with any two boys of that age, just, you know, just for ickiness and that kind of thing.
Point well taken.
I also can't imagine parents, whether they be liberal or conservative, of a daughter wanting to allow that. And well, I don't understand why any so-called social prestige would have any factor in where somebody sent their child and their college dollars. That's what I'm trying to say. Their money. I just don't understand any kind of so-called benefit that way. I would much rather send my child to a conservative university or a Christian university, knowing what kind of influence she was going to get.
Yeah, I'm sure with you, Sienna. By the way, good point on the icky factor. That's legit. That's true. Every parent understands that. But let's also get to your deeper point, which really has to do with the morality at stake here. I'll tell you, the sad thing, Sienna, is that there clearly are plenty of parents willing to write the bills for the prestige of a Stanford or University of Chicago degree while putting their children at risk. I'm with you. Horrible bargain, but there it is. The phone number is 877-893-8255. Back with more calls on the Albert Mueller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mueller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. This whole idea of mandatory mixed sex, mixed gender dorm rooms is so far beyond the imagination. I did a little check just so folks around here, and we're out a lot. We're on these campuses a lot. And this is news to just about everyone I have talked to. And this is not talking about co-ed dorms, co-ed campuses. This is talking about co-ed dormitory rooms. And there's just so much going on here. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Let's go to Larry calling from Orlando, Florida. Go ahead, Larry.
Thank you. I really hope you wake the parents up, because all of us that have gone to college already knew about the promiscuity that was going on. I mean, it was crazy already when we went to school there. Now they're just breaking the door down. And my point is, it doesn't matter if you get a degree from Harvard or somewhere like Stanford if your life is ruined. I mean, how many more abortions and souls will be lost because of the complex immorality that will be going on?
You know, Larry, I can't think of a better way to put it than the way you just ended it, complex immorality. And, this really is complex because part of the immorality going on here is what's only going to be in the minds of those in these rooms and what's only going to be going on in the culture of those. You know, there's a sexual reticence, a sexual modesty that is very much a part of our integrity as human beings and especially integrity as Christians. And I don't think I'm being incredibly revelatory here. I'm not having an Oprah moment here. But I'll just tell you, as a young man or an older man, I could not be in this situation without sin. I just promise you that. It wouldn't happen. And it's just a horrifying thought to me that this would happen in the first place, that it would happen in a mandatory fashion in the second place, and that it would happen without parents knowing in the third place. And being able to do anything about it. I mean, Stanford University basically told Karen Venerable Morin and her husband, you just send the check and shut up, because this is our policy, that's just the way it is, and if you don't pay the bills, some other parent would be very glad to pay the bills just to have the prestige of a Stanford degree. Larry, thanks so much for your call. And by the way, thanks for your honest and candid assessment about the sexual promiscuity on campuses. Let me tell you, it is so there on almost any major public or private university campus. You can just see it everywhere. And I'll tell you, one of the places you see it, you go in the campus and you go in the student building. That's one of the places you should go if you want to understand what a campus is all like. And by the way, I'm going to do a program basically in the fall. We're going to schedule it in the fall on how to visit a college campus and read it. I think it'd be very interesting. It might help parents to understand if you're looking especially for the class of 2010 making these decisions. How do you go to campus and read it? Go to the campus center, the student center, and look at the offices on the first floor. You know, what's given the office space? And you're going to find sex clinics in many cases right there. You can just walk in. You can just get your contraception or birth control device of choice. You can just walk in and get it, and the dorms are wide open, and, well, you can write the script. And it's worse than that on many of these campuses. Let's go to Louisville, Kentucky. Richard's calling, listening on WFIA. Go ahead, Richard.
Hi, Dr. Mola. My question is, aside from the morality problem that we're obviously facing, what kind of legal problems is it going to cause if, say, you have a guy and a girl dorm together and the guy rapes the girl?
Yeah, you know, I'm not a lawyer, and I wouldn't pretend to be one, Richard, but just a little hunch here. My guess is that these students and whoever's paying the bill have to pay have to sign a basic housing contract that probably has a waiver of all that. And you ask a question that gets back to the most basic question. What parent in his right mind would do that? What parent in his right mind would do that? Let me tell you, here's another little secret. And this is something I had not intended to bring up here, but I'm going to bring it up right now. I wonder how many parents really take into consideration the fact that if their child is 18 years of age or older, they have no access to the grades, no access to the financial records, no access to the student records on campus, no access to the disciplinary issues on campus because, according to federal legislation, that's off limits. The child's an adult, and the child decides whether you get to see the grades, whether you get to see the records, whether you get to see the disciplinary issues, or see anything else. I would not pay one penny of my child's tuition at any college or university without a waiver of that disclosure. I would make sure that my child signed over a waiver so that I, as parent, have access to everything, or there's not a tuition bill, not a housing bill, not a book bill, not a Starbucks first drink of coffee bill paid until that's signed. All right, little sermon preached in there. Take it from a college president. Get that document and have it signed, or don't pay the bills. Let's go to Louisville, Kentucky. Nia's on the line listening on WFIA. What do you think, Nia?
I would just say that I went to college, and between the hormones and being safe in a room, I would have a super problem sending my child to a campus where they would have to room with a male that hormones might be jumping and might rape them, or just the hormones that run rampant at that age that, you know, when you're not in the same room, at least you can say, I gotta go.
Yeah, yeah, but you know, there are protections certainly in place in separate rooms that aren't there in the same room. And I appreciate your passion, by the way. And rather descriptive way of making your point, and I appreciate that. You know, what you're really looking at here, and by the way, you're asking if the hormones are jumping, they're jumping. And by the way, at that age, yes, at that age, and especially at that age, but don't write it off any other age. Let me put it this way, and this is an interesting point. Let's just think about this. Let me ask you to imagine a parallel. Let's say that your corporation is having a business trip, and the corporation says, you, man, are going to have to room with that woman on this business trip. You're not going to have any choice. That's simply the way it's going to be done. And you're going to share a hotel room. I don't think there's anyone on the planet who would say that's an acceptable arrangement. I don't think there's anyone who would look at that and say it's not about sex. I don't think there's anyone who would look at that and say that's not a basically immoral, unacceptable, virtually unthinkable context. Okay, how in the world is it different to put two young girls and two young guys in a dorm room at Stanford University, University of Chicago, or at least 50 other universities and say, you're going to have to live together. Oh, and it's not about the sex. Right. I do agree with the New York Times. It is probably more about the sexual politics, about breaking down every barrier between what it means to be male and what it means to be female. I think the New York Times probably tipped its hat, revealed a bit something there to us, and something we better pay attention to as Christian parents. We're living in a world gone mad. This is just one example. A strange, surprising, and shocking example, to be sure. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. We're living in very strange times, and one of the examples of the strangeness, one of the glaring, flashing lights of our day, is anything related to sexuality in general, homosexuality in particular. So you won't be surprised that one of the major questions now emerging as President Barack Obama faces the opportunity of naming his first nominee to the United States Supreme Court, the question is whether or not he would pick an openly gay man or woman to be the first openly gay man or woman to be a justice of the United States Supreme Court. Very, very interesting. Several of the people mentioned are indeed known to be gay or lesbian. Among them, for instance, would be Kathleen Sullivan, former dean of the Stanford University Law School. We're just talking about Stanford University. Its former law school dean is an out lesbian and is mentioned as a potential justice for the Supreme Court. Pam Carlin, one of the other ones who's frequently mentioned. She said, by the way, it's no secret at all that I'm counted among the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender crowd. It's LGBT. She said, given the landscape, I'm flattered that is to be mentioned as a possible justice, but not fooled by having my name tossed around. It's very interesting. When you look at this, it's just a reminder that when people ask, why does homosexuality come up again and again and again? Well, here it's not coming up because conservatives are saying President Obama better not appoint an openly gay justice to the U.S. Supreme Court. No, it's coming as those who are pushing the agenda for the normalization of homosexuality say it would be a powerful symbolic gain for our movement if indeed President Obama were to choose an openly gay person to be a justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. You see, a part of the sexual revolution that we are now witnessing is the in-your-face, we have to talk about sex all the time, agenda that says, if you do not claim me and know me and validate me with my sexuality, my sexual preferences, my sexual practices, then you're discriminating against me. You know, there may have been a homosexual justice to the U.S. Supreme Court in the past. Who knows? The issue is there's never been an openly homosexual justice, which means there's never been a justice who's made an issue out of it in times past. But in order to validate homosexuality, this movement is pushing these issues continually. I often get the question, why is it conservative Christians talk about this so much? Well, we're not the ones who initiated this news story, but it is a real indication of where we are indeed as a society. Everything now is politicized. Everything is sexualized. You can draw a direct line from the sexual revolution to the fact that now everything is debated in a context in which sex is at least a part, if not in the foreground. Tells us a great deal about living in a Genesis 3 world and what it means for Christians to maintain sexual sanity in the midst of all this confusion. Parents, beware. We'll be back tomorrow for Intelligent Christian Conversation. Thanks for listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmueller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmueller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.